It is well known that Evansville, Indiana, suffered one of the first U.S. casualties in World War I. But there is an Evansville story at the end of that war of triumph, tragedy, and sacrifice that has gone almost completely unnoticed until now. I'm Steve Berger, and this is Chester and Gertrude at War. Over 122,000 Americans were killed or wounded in the Meuse-Argonne Offensive, the battle that brought an end to World War I in the fall of 1918. It remains the largest battle in U.S. military history. On a monument at Wadlandcourt, France, honoring U.S. Army 1st Division casualties in one area of that massive battle, there were 215 names. Now there are 216.
I wanted to come with champagne, but it's too hot.
The addition is obvious and will no doubt prompt questions from future visitors.
This is so exciting.
Nancy Hastings of Posey County, Indiana, has an answer for them.
I would tell them it's there to honor a forgotten soldier.
The journey that ended at the monument in 2018 began with a box of letters.
Dear Chester.
Dear Mother and Dad.
Well, kiddo, if you think you can get to come home, wire us as soon as you know.
I am now located with a new outfit. Our company was split to pieces to replace a part of the 1st Division.
In the morning yesterday, the officials of War Mothers had a meeting at Mrs. Weintz's.
I'm expecting to see some real service soon. The company is about reorganized.
Mr. Stocking roused us from our slumbers as he was returning from the courier office. He shouted aloud, "The war is over! An armistice is signed!"
To be opened only in the event I do not return.
What Nancy found was an unusually complete collection of letters between her great-uncle, U.S. Army Sergeant Chester Schultz of Evansville, and his family.
It was a story I'd known all my life, but looking through a box and realized that all these letters were there, you know, and just opening them, reading them, and I thought, well, this is pretty interesting.
The letters provide insight into the life of an American soldier and life on the home front in World War I. Nancy has put her family's story into a book called A Tragedy of the Great War.
It's not that I'm glad that those things happened, but if they hadn't happened, he would just be another uncle. He's much more than that to me now because of the letters and the story and the whole ordeal.
Photographs and news clippings in the box also detailed the triumph of Chester's mother, Gertrude Schultz, who was instrumental in forming a national women's organization to support the war effort. But it is the letters that carry the gut-wrenching truth of a mother's heartache and desperate pleading for answers following the end of World War I. It was an ordeal from which she would never recover. Like most of the country, America's entry into World War I came as no surprise to Evansville. By April of 1917, the area had already formed infantry and artillery units for the National Guard. A cavalry company had even been proposed. Vandenberg County historian Stan Schmidt says the Red Cross mobilized immediately and fundraising began to help finance the war.
Basically, over the course of the next year and a half, there were five loans, the last one they called the Victory Loan. But people pledged money to the government for the war effort. Evansville, over the course of the five loans, pledged over $22 million. And you're talking 1917-18 money.
Something else that began almost immediately, draft notices were sent to raise a contingent of soldiers from Indiana and Illinois.
The Army realized real quick they were talking about millions of men to Europe. Everybody between the right age groups, all men had to register.
One of those notices went to 24-year-old Chester Elmer Schultz of Evansville, an accountant at the Hercules Buggy Company, member of his church's choir, as well as the local Freemasons. Chester was engaged to be married to a woman named Lorena Stocking, who he affectionately referred to as Socks. Chester Schultz was the youngest of four children, three boys and a girl. His father, Albert, was a salesman for the Indiana Stove Company. The family was comfortable financially. His mother, Gertrude, was active in the Jefferson Avenue Presbyterian Church. There is no indication that Chester resented putting his life on hold for the Army. His letters home reveal a young man eager for adventure.
Our company hopes not to be cheated out of a good scrap with the Hun. We are all in fine spirits, and do not worry about me, for I am in the place I want to be.
On arriving for basic training at Camp Zachary Taylor in Louisville, Chester was assigned to the 84th Division. He was quickly promoted to corporal and then sergeant in April of the following year.
Somewhere in Kentucky, Monday evening. Dear Sis and Marion, I guess you think I'm a peach for not writing oftener, but really, sis, I don't get the time anymore. It seems that a sergeant's work is never done. We have to be forever and eternally making out reports and details after regular drill hours.
A mother's love and close family ties are woven throughout the weekly letters Gertrude Schultz wrote to her son.
Well, kiddo, if you think you can get to come home, wire us as soon as you know. Lillian had planned to go to Oakland Sunday, but when she heard you might come, she says she'll not go, as she can go there any time. So let us know just what's what as soon as you know, with lots of love from Mother and Dad.
Gertrude Schultz's care for her son sparked a national movement of women supporting the troops. An account of Evansville's role in World War I, Sons of Men, came out shortly after the war. The author, Herman Blatt, wrote that during a visit to Chester at Camp Taylor, Gertrude had the idea to form a women's group to support the troops. Stan Schmidt says the idea was immediately popular.
She talked to different people, and the idea kind of caught on. And they set up the local, the War Mothers in Evansville. A little bit later, a congressman from Indiana introduced in Washington a bill to give them a national charter.
July 18, 1918, to Camp Sherman, Thursday morning. Dear Chester, in the morning yesterday, the officials of War Mothers had a meeting at Mrs. Weintz's to lay plans for our convention. Arrived home at 12:30.
The new group was called the War Mothers of America. Gertrude Schultz was its acting president. Blatt noted that by the time of the first national convention, there were 2 million women in the U.S. who were interested in the movement. Army life seemed to suit Chester, despite their rigorous basic training at Camp Taylor.
Our brigade left camp last Friday morning and made this hike. We marched 17 miles under full pack in a hot day. We start back on the return trip in the morning, and I sure hope it is cooler. So far, these hikes haven't hurt me in the least, and I have even helped carry other men's packs.
A daily schedule from the archives of Camp Taylor shows that Reveille called at 5:45 a.m., and the men were almost continually active until taps was sounded at 10:30 at night.
Our platoon is one of the few that have come through these hikes without losing a man. It was due to the fact that we didn't sympathize with them when they began dragging, but instead just urged them on and brought them all into camp. Lots of love. Your kid brother, check.
They received training in the use of bayonets, grenades, and machine guns. They held mock hand-to-hand combat skirmishes in makeshift trenches. That would later prove almost useless, though, in actual combat. In September of 1918, their basic training complete, Chester and Company K boarded the troop ship Carmala at the massive military port of Hoboken, New Jersey. Chester noted an anniversary in his letter.
Aboard transport. Dear Mother and Dad, English Channel. It was a year ago today that we pulled out of the station for our introduction to military life. We have traveled and marched many a mile since then, and today are between 4,000 and 5,000 miles from home. I don't regret being here, but can't hardly realize I'm so far away.
Thank you. The summer of 1918 flew by for Gertrude as she dealt with details of the War Mothers' first national convention. It was to be held at the Soldiers and Sailors Memorial Coliseum, finished just 2 years earlier as Evansville's showcase venue.
Evansville Courier, September 18, 1918. They are here, the War Mothers. They have come from every part of the country to be present at the first national convention and to help in organizing the first society of its kind ever known in history. Quite a number of the mothers arrived yesterday, and each train into the city this morning will bring its load of women who have their boys overseas for the sake of democracy.
Over 200 delegates from 22 states and the District of Columbia were on hand to hear Gertrude's opening remarks to the gathering.
Ladies, with great pleasure, I greet you and welcome you here. You, the mothers, wives, sisters, and may I add the sweethearts and friends of our grandest army that has ever fought in a war, have gathered from far and near to organize another army that shall stand shoulder to shoulder with that army over there. By our united effort, we can do great things, and our boys shall realize that we can fight as well as they, using our own weapons. For our God, our country, humanity, and our boys, we may do anything that may become a woman.
A highlight of the convention was a cablegram from Chester that arrived during the event saying that the Evansville troops had arrived safely overseas. The news was greeted with loud cheers. Another message to the convention from a little higher up is dated the 18th. It was a telegram from President Woodrow Wilson thanking the group for their support of the war effort. The commander of the American Expeditionary Forces in Europe, General John J. Pershing, took time out a few days later to add his congratulations.
Mrs. Gertrude Schultz, Evansville, President of War Mothers of America, September 22nd. The splendid example of patience and bravery which American mothers have set for their sons is a tremendous inspiration to the American Expeditionary Forces. In the name of these troops, I thank you for a message which assures us of the courageous spirit. Pershing.
The same day that he sent that telegram to Gertrude, September 22nd, General Pershing formally assumed command of the Meuse-Argonne sector of northern France. It was in preparation for the offensive that would put Gertrude's son on a cold, soggy hillside near the village of Chavoges 6 weeks later. Our search to document Chester's experience in the American Expeditionary Force took us to France in July of 2018, along with Nancy and her sister Anne Stevenson.
Did you know his name was not going to?
No, not until I walked up there.
By going to France, we were able to bring context and clarity to the century-old letters and military records. It helped Nancy discover new information to update her account of her family's story.
No food and. Was it rainy?
It was bad weather.
Okay.
Yeah.
See, I didn't know that.
Our journey to trace the steps of Chester Schultz begins in Mussedan, a small village in southwestern France. That's where Chester received some additional training before heading to the front lines.
I think of this time for Chester to be such a peaceful time and a nice time.
Waiting for us were local museum director Ludovic Chachenia and translator Christian Tildemann. Based on one of Chester's letters, Ludovic researched village archives and found
a magasin.
A store, warehouse, and stable.
Oui, mais là, magasin à tabac, donc c'est ce
qu'on a vu. Oh, so those aren't people's names, those are businesses.
Tobacco, what we have seen, and you have the houses are described due to their use, what they were for.
Okay.
Donc c'est, ça peut nous aider des fois, ça pourrait plus nous aider à trouver où c'était.
We might be able to find the place where Chester and his platoon stayed while they trained in Mussedan. The individual soldiers at the locations were not listed, but Chester left some clues in his letter.
We are billeted in the stable of an old Frenchman who has three daughters in the Red Cross and two sons in the service. He has lost one daughter. He is a fine old man and treats Chintrup and I just fine.
With Chester's account and the village records, Ludovic is able to narrow the possible billeting location down to a handful of farms. According to Chester's letter, even though they spent their days preparing for battle, they also had time to enjoy themselves far from home in the French countryside.
They live on grapes, black bread, wine, and mushrooms. I brought them a piece of white bread and a canteen of coffee, and their eyes got big, and they called the bread cake. Since then, they can't do enough for us. They want Chintrup and I to drink wine with them all the time. If we drank as much as they wanted us to, we would be drunk all the time.
Chester's letter comes to life as we tour a farm on the outskirts of Mussidon. As Nancy retraces his steps, she realizes it was in Mussidon that Chester celebrated his 26th birthday on October 6th, 1918.
The name of this small part is Seguinou.
Okay. Seguinou. Seguinou, il y a trois fermes et on avait trois noms. Donc on est sûr que les trois fermes.
In Seguinou, we have only three farms and we have three names. Okay. So we are sure that at least American soldiers were
in these barns. Yes.
Yes, were billeted here.
Yes. Yes.
There is one thing I don't understand. They have blackberries here so thick you can't make an impression on them, and they are drying on the bushes yet they think they are poison. Believe me, we boys sure make use of them. We have blackberries stewed and in cobblers three times a day.
Séparés par des haies de ronces, d'arbres quelconques.
At that time there were many because all fields were separated with this kind
with
of
that for the yes. There was a hedge around the fields.
Exactly. Yes, and there were a lot.
See, all the good ones that are ripe are back there, too far to reach.
Ah,
everybody's picked these
ones.
The Mussidon is a beautiful town for one thing, and it's just I think of this time for Chester to be such a peaceful time and a nice time, and it's really great to get to see some of the actual places he was and to actually walk in the train station where he arrived. It was very touching for me to think, you know, this is where he was 100 years ago. So it's much more real, much more exciting to me right now.
Far from peaceful in other parts of France, battles were exacting a high cost on the American troops. One of the most graphic accounts of the German army's strategy in the Meuse-Argonne offensive was written by a lieutenant assigned to Company M of the 28th Infantry Regiment. The account of Maury Maverick appeared in the book Doughboy War by James Hallis.
We had reckoned without a German rearguard action, and no doubt they had heard us telling our men to get ready. They were soldiers who had trained 4 years at the front. They had left their lines checkerboarded with machine guns, had left their men in the rear to fight to the death, and had slowly moved out of the heavy masses of troops. Most of us who were young American officers knew little of actual warfare. We had daring, but not the training of the old officer of the front. The Germans simply waited, and then laid a barrage of steel and fire, and the machine gunners poured it on us. Our company numbered 200 men. Within a few minutes, about half of them were either dead or wounded.
Desperate, after suffering thousands of casualties in the summer and fall of 1918, unit commanders went looking for replacements. They found them in Mussidon.
October 18th, 1918. Dear Mother and Dad, I am now located with a new outfit. Our company was split to pieces to replace a part of the 1st Division. Green, Saunders, Schaffner, and I are still together. The 1st Division was the first to arrive in France and have gone through some of the hardest fighting. They have made a name for themselves that will go down in history. We are hoping to get a chance to help them maintain the name and also make a little more history of the kind they have made.
In his next letters from France, we get a glimpse into Chester's life as he got closer to the front. The language is harsher, the sentences more fragmented, and it's clear the men are training hard for the upcoming battle.
October 22nd. We didn't get time to write. We haven't had time for a decent wash in the last week or two. After being out all day and then non-com special hikes at night, we are damned glad to hit our hay. Started this last night but was interrupted by a Boche plane who decided to pay us a visit. We had to put our lights out until he was chased away. It was our first experience in an air raid. He didn't do any damage or make a direct hit. However, he made it interesting around here. I'm expecting to see some real service soon. The company is about reorganized now. I have the first platoon to take over. We have only two officers in the company, so you see it's up to the non-coms to take the boys over.
Armed with military accounts of the 28th Infantry and Company K, images shot by military combat photographers and two local experts, our group begins tracing the steps of Chester Schultz in northern France. Richard Tucker runs a service called Tucker Tours, giving military history tours of the area around Sedan. Chris Sims retired after more than 40 years with the American Battlefield Monuments Commission, the organization which maintains American cemeteries and monuments in Europe from both world wars. We meet with Richard and Chris in the garden of our bed and breakfast in Sedan to go over maps of the troop movements that would help us trace the path of Chester Schultz.
They were fit men, weren't they?
I know. I mean, all they were really moving along. And then that last day. With equipment. They were marching because it said by the end of the time they were relieved up there, they had gone 65 hours straight marching and going with only the rations they had on their back.
You know, so no, and in the rain.
No food. And was it raining?
It was bad weather.
Okay.
Yeah.
See, I didn't know that. Wow.
We begin tracing Chester's steps in battle at the village of Shehery. It was there at sunrise, accounts record that Company K took its first fire from German machine gunners. It was 7 a.m. on November 7th, 1918.
So from here on, it would have been real. You know, it would have been, you know, the first fire actually on them and this push to go. From now on, they know there's Germans anywhere. So it would have been real.
From Shehery, Chester and Company K marched up the west side of the Sedan Road, along the Bar River to the village of Chevauges. Film footage of that day shows American troops under fire as they run crouched over on the road leading into Chevauges. Company K, with Chester leading the first platoon, was ordered to the northwest of the village to attack a German machine gun position a short distance away on what was known as Hill 334. They stopped in the cover of the walled cemetery at Chevauges to plan their attack. It was about 7:30 in the morning.
The report from the 28th history says there was no artillery support and all resistance was overcome by sheer force of frontal attack. So it's just depending all on these guys with rifles in their hands. On the heights that now lay ahead, the Germans had prepared to make a desperate stand, for the loss of these hills meant the loss of Sedan.
Retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Tom Orlowski, president of the 1st Infantry Division Memorial Association, is a highly decorated infantry officer. We asked Lieutenant Colonel Orlowski how the soldiers may have reacted as they contemplated leaving the relative safety of the walled cemetery and moving directly into the fire of the German machine gun.
Some folks immediately fall apart. Most of them say, make it through this. And some others are just anxious to get in the fight. So it depends. There isn't one consistent through the soldiers' psyche that would be able to say, yeah, it's like this. Those privates and specialists and sergeants, they're sitting out there and they say, I hope that dumb bastard behind us doesn't tell us to get up and rush this machine gun, you know.
But the order to attack did come. Comparing photographs from 1918 with what is there now, a chilling truth emerges. The distance between the front gate of the Chevauche Cemetery and the likely site of the German machine gun is a little less than a mile. There is not now, nor was there a century ago, any cover, only a small dip in the terrain about halfway in between in an expanse of open farm fields.
As we stand here in the trees where the German machine guns were, was less than a mile away. They're down here at the cemetery looking up the bare ground toward those trees, and they're about to go right towards it.
Yes. I'm not sure I could have done it.
We asked Tom Orlovsky what Chester was facing as the leader of the 1st Platoon ordered to advance across the open field toward the machine gun.
In many cases, in order to get folks out of their foxholes, you jump up and you go first. But when you do that, you're not thinking about yourself, you're not thinking about anything. And pretty much most soldiers after the first battle feel pretty invincible. You know, oh hell, I'll live. Guy next to me might not have, but I will.
A quote attributed by some historians to General Pershing after the war went, "We won because the men were willing to pay the price." Based on historical accounts, their knowledge of military tactics, and a map, we go out to a certain spot in that open field with Richard Tucker and Chris Sims.
It's also more likely they'd be near the road because they might be able to think they can dash to where the track is and there might be some a ditch next to it or something. If they're walking halfway between them, they can't run anywhere.
No.
So I think they are nearish to the road.
I gotta pick a spot.
I think you're gonna be roughly right here.
I think we're probably right.
Yeah, I mean, like, they've seen the Americans, they've got an idea they're coming. They're too far away when they're down there.
Nancy Hastings is carrying a bouquet of flowers.
Once they get to here, you know, they're not gonna run away, they'll go to ground. They just keep shooting at them until they've yeah. shot enough of them.
At the age of 26 years and 31 days, Sergeant Chester Schultz of Evansville, Indiana, former accountant at the Hercules Buggy Company, member of the church choir, beloved son, brother, and fiancé, died on that hillside along with seven other Americans. It was just after 8 o'clock in the morning on November 7th, 1918. Nancy Hastings gently places the bouquet of flowers on the stubble of the harvested wheat field.
I'm probably not a pretty crier.
Does that feel like an end
by putting that there?
A little bit. I mean, it's kind of been the search for where he was killed for them and for me for a long time. And I think we're pretty close. I mean, it I'm sure it's not the exact spot, but it's got to be fairly close.
Nancy hugs her sister Anne for a long moment and then steps back to snap images that will be quickly attached to messages for their families back in the U.S.
I think he died fairly quickly because of where he's buried. He didn't survive long enough to be taken back to a hospital at all, so I think it was a fairly quick death.
Chris Sims described what would have happened on the hillside shortly after the battle.
In Chester's case, 7 November, it was terrible weather. It was chilly, it was wet, and of course the burial parties with their winter coats and the heavy equipment would have slogged along as well to and hastily in a muddy field bury the dead.
Official accounts of the day indicate the rest of the company and other units were scattered and pinned down all day, unable to advance. They were relieved and finally got a hot meal and rest on the evening of November 7th. For the surviving members of 1st Platoon and Company K, the war was over. Evansville celebrated with the rest of the nation when word came that the armistice had been signed. In the weeks since the War Mothers Convention, Gertrude had been busy working with Chester's fiancée, Lorena, and other women to raise money and shape the organization designed to provide assistance to soldiers' families, especially those families which faced financial hardship because of the war. In her joy and relief at news of the armistice, Gertrude dashed off a quick letter to Chester.
November 11, 1918, 5 a.m. Dear Chester, at 3:30 this a.m., Mr. Stocking roused us from our slumbers as he was returning from the courier office. He shouted aloud, "The war is over! An armistice is signed!" Dad went downstairs and woke Ray to tell him the good news. Then he called up Lillian all before 4 o'clock. But they could afford to lose some sleep with such joyful news. Now, dear Chuck, let us hear from you at once, so we know that you are safe. Then our cup of joy will be filled with loads and loads of love. A happy Thanksgiving and a joyful Xmas from Mother and Dad.
Not knowing that Chester had been killed in France just 4 days earlier, the letter was the first of many miscommunications, mistakes, and rumors that surfaced over the next few months, including some from official sources. Because of her celebrity as the president of the National Women's Organization, the tragedy played out in the public spotlight. What Gertrude would later refer to as the suspense and sorrow of the family's ordeal was just beginning.
Evansville Courier, December 29, 1918. Chester Schultz badly wounded. Various rumors current about the city regarding Sergeant Chester E. Schultz, son of Mr. and Mrs. A.J. Schultz, 200 Jefferson Avenue, were quieted yesterday on the receipt of the following telegram from Washington. Deeply regret to inform that it is officially reported that Chester E. Schultz, infantry, was severely wounded in action November 7. Several days ago, a local soldier wrote home and told of Sergeant Schultz having been killed in action. As Mrs. Schultz is president of the local War Mothers Organization, her prominence added fuel to the rumor.
Dear Chester, my dear boy, 3 months since this terrible war is over, and as yet haven't heard one word as to your whereabouts or your health. Not a word written by you since October 23rd, and to Lorena, 27th of October. I know God is caring for you in answer, not only to my prayers, but many, many more. But oh, how I yearn to get one line written by you. Many of the boys are home and still coming, but none know a word about you. I've written to every corner of France, but no information whatever. So if this message should chance to reach you, try to send us a cable. I've asked everyone I've written to, but none so far. If General Pershing can help you out, appeal to him. I know he's a friend to all you boys, but hope someone, wherever you are located, will let us know. Dad and I are holding the old fort, or at least I am, with Nellie as my guard, as Dad has been on the road again since the first of the year and is fine trade and feeling pretty good. I wouldn't leave the old fort, as I'm daily expecting to hear something of you. Now, my dear boy, I hope you're getting along all okay, and that God will bless and keep you until you reach the shores of home. Let us hear, and with all the love that can come from a mother and father's heart.
sad. I mean, it's still just so poignant to me. 100 years later, just you can just feel in all of that. You know, she's telling them, just wanting to hear from him. And then just a little news from home, you know, kind of bringing him up to date is what all's been happening while he's gone. But just the not even leaving home, you know, for 4 months. She's sitting home thinking someday somebody's going to come forward where you are.
Evansville Press, March 6, 1919. Son of war mother's leader is killed. In doubt for the past 4 months whether her son, Sergeant Chester Schultz, was alive or dead, Mrs. A.J. Schultz, first president of the War Mothers of America, has been writing to him weekly, hoping that somewhere her son was still alive. Thursday, she received official notice that he was dead. The last time I saw Chester, he was leading the first platoon over the top. Miles Saunders, son of Min Saunders, rode in December. And that's the picture Mrs. Schultz has always with her now, of her son, her baby boy, she calls him, leading his men over the top. It was recalled Thursday that when the first official word came that Sergeant Schultz was wounded, the local War Mothers organization, through a mistake of the florist, sent cut flowers to the Schultz's home, symbolizing a dead son, instead of a growing plant signifying a wounded hero.
What happened? Why did it take 4 agonizing months to be notified of Chester's death? Researching records at the 1st Division Museum in Chicago, Nancy found an important clue. When replacements were hastily shoved into the 1st Division shortly after leaving Musadon, Miles Saunders, Charles Schaffner, and Jacob Green of Evansville are listed with their new unit. But the name of Sergeant C.E. Schultz is never listed on Company K's monthly roster. Tom Orlowski says it doesn't make any sense to us today, but we should look at the incident from a historical perspective.
When you think back to how confusing battlefronts were in World War I and the lack of communication and the immediacy of the action versus, you know, what we consider to be a very important thing, but at the moment getting fresh troops there is much more important than writing all the names accurately, and they felt they could go back and recreate the situation in lists.
The mystery was solved. At his proudest moment, leaving Musadon as a member of the Big Red One, no one but his closest buddies knew that Chester Schultz was even there. It would take months for the Army to realize its error.
When they're checking the list, you know, whenever the battle's over and the company rejoins itself and they're checking, okay, you're here, you're here, you're here, there was no name for Chester. And, you know, he wasn't missed. It's a little bit ironic to me because if this hadn't happened, if they hadn't left his name off, it would just be another story of a death in World War I.
In the weeks following the official notification of Chester being killed in action, more details emerged from soldiers who were with him that day. One gave an account of Chester's death.
Caven Rock, Illinois, May 18th, 1919. Dear Mrs. Schultz, I knew Sergeant Schultz while in France. I knew him for a jolly good friend as well as a soldier, and I'm sorry to have to tell you of his death. I saw him fall on the battlefield while we were forced to push ahead. I believe he died there. Of course, I hadn't time to get down and examine his body, but I'm sure he was dead, and our corporal said his last words were, "I'm wounded." Such is life, and we can do nothing more noble than give our lives for our country. Truly yours, Luther Riley.
To be opened only in the event I do not return. Dear Mother and Dad, I write this to you knowing that you will follow my wishes. I have done my bit for the country, but leave the ones behind that were all the world to me. But don't be sad, as I feel it an honor and want you to feel the same way. I have 2 insurance policies, one for $2,500 and one for $1,000. I want you to have the $2,500 policy, but wants you to give to Lorena the $1,000 policy, as I took this out since we were engaged. I do this not because I don't want you to have it all, but because I know Lorena's disposition and think that she can probably forget by going away for a while or anything she sees fit. May God's blessing be with you all. Your son, Chester.
The military's Graves Registration Service was established in 1917 because U.S. officials decided that none of the families of casualties in the war would want their loved ones to be buried in Europe. They were wrong, and the chaos that ensued delayed the return of some soldiers' remains, like those of Chester Schultz. In April of 1919, Chester's body was disinterred and moved with over 800 other remains in outlying gravesites to a temporary cemetery a few miles away at Latton. Chris Sims says the work of moving the bodies is difficult to imagine.
It was a very gruesome task, and up to a point that many of these who worked for the Graves Registration Service had no sense of smell or taste, so they actually would not have experienced the the stench of death. And from the film footage I've seen on the procedure of disinterment and processing of the remains, it seemed to me that it all became an automatism. So there were actually no personal feelings towards the remains, but they were doing a job, and they kept on, you know, one was processed, the next was in line to be processed, and so on.
In Evansville, Gertrude Schultz had no question about where she wanted her son's remains to be. It was clear in a letter she wrote in response to the government's query of the families of U.S. casualties.
We deeply grieve over the loss of our dear son. The War Department has promised to send the remains home to those who so wished. I'm looking forward to the time when his remains will be sent to us, where we have a beautiful cemetery. And my only comfort through all the suspense and sorrow will be to have him placed in our family lot, where we, his family, can place flowers on his grave. I feel sure my country will carry out all its promises and return our dear one to us as soon as it possibly can be done.
Gertrude had to deal with the final details of Chester's return on her own. Chester's father, A.J. Schultz, died in November of 1920. News accounts of the funeral of Chester Schultz in April of 1921 indicate that hundreds of people turned out for a large procession. His pallbearers included the three Evansville men who transferred with him to the 1st Division at Musadon. He was buried for the last time in Oak Hill Cemetery. As Chester indicated she might do in his final letter, his fiancée, Lorena Stocking, did go away, moving to Pittsburgh and later Chicago, but apparently she did not forget. Lorena returned to Evansville for Chester's funeral. The woman Chester referred to as Sox never married. Lorena Stocking died in 1952. There is no marker today, but records show her cremated remains were buried near her parents' graves, also in Oak Hill Cemetery. Gertrude Schultz's time in the national spotlight was short-lived. The strain and heartache of the family's ordeal affected her deeply. While she continued her public service in various ways, privately, she would mourn Chester's loss until her own death in 1929. The only living descendant with personal memory of Gertrude Schultz is a granddaughter, another Gertrude, Gertrude Lant. Now living in a nursing home and no longer able to speak, we recorded this account in 2009. This personal story of her famous grandmother is told through the eyes of a young child.
Well, she was short and fat and soft. And I loved to go there. And she had a great big stuffed teddy bear.
Gertrude Lant says she does not remember her grandmother ever speaking of her time in the national spotlight, but she says her grandmother and Gertrude Lant's mother, Lillian, often spoke of the family's personal tragedy, the death of Sergeant Chester Schultz.
Oh, yes, they talked a lot because my grandmother loved him so. She talked about he was killed on the day before the armistice was signed, and that broke her heart to think that he was so close to coming home and didn't quite make it. She used to say that poem a lot in Flanders Field, "The Poppies Grow Between the Crosses, Row on Row." And the tears would just roll down her face.
The 2018 visit was Nancy's second trip to the 1st Division Monument at Wadlin Court. While waiting at the monument in July, Nancy and Anne discussed a disappointing discovery Nancy made during her visit in 2014.
Did you know his name was not
going to be? No, not until I walked up there. I walked up there and we read, we read every single name, looked in every possible place, like Missing in Action.
Chester's name was not on the monument. Nancy couldn't do anything about the ordeal her family suffered because of the clerical error that caused Chester Schultz's death notification to be withheld for several months after the war. But she decided to do something about the monument. The owner of the Wadlin Court Monument is the 1st Infantry Division Memorial Association. Association President Tom Orlowski says it prompted a historic discussion for the organization's board of directors.
No one else has asked us to add a name. So it was a very rare event. So they all said most definitely it should be done. And that's when I had to go look for somebody who could make them. Anyone who lost his life or her life in defense of this country or to advance freedom should be recognized, even if it's 100 years ago.
Claude Zanet has been caring for the Wadlin Court Monument for the past 40 years. We met him at the monument at the appointed time, 10 o'clock. We brought along the owners of the Bed and Breakfast, Michelle Corrin and Charlotte LeRae, in hopes that a local tie would convince Claude Zanet to agree to our request. After much discussion alongside a highway with trucks and cars whizzing by, Charlotte gave us the answer.
This guy has all the equipment in order actually to do it right now.
Right now, so he can go home again?
Yeah. Oh! So you will have everything.
Get it done.
That's amazing. It is. Yay!
The century-long wait for recognition for Chester Schultz was nearly over. For all the weeks and months of trying to get the plaque installed, it only took a few minutes once Claude Zanet returned with a generator, a drill, and some other tools. He and Michelle made quick work of measuring, drilling, gluing, and placing the screws. They were only interrupted when Nancy asked if she could make the final turns on the screws herself.
You all just want to see me work. This is cool. This is just cool. Who would think that I would get to install this plaque?
or help install it.
A bouquet of flowers was placed alongside the plaque which reads 28th Infantry, Company K, Sergeant C.E. Schultz. While the bronze plaque matches the rest of the monument, it is an obvious addition. It's easy to imagine that future visitors will reach for a wireless device to check the name. I asked Nancy Hastings what she would say to them.
I would tell them it's there to honor a forgotten soldier who should have been up there with his fellow Company K mates, and that even though he didn't make it there 100 years later, we still care enough that he gets the recognition he deserves. Yeah.
There is a historical footnote to this story. The most controversial part of the War Mothers 1918 convention turned out to be the name. While the Evansville group prevailed then, at the next convention a year later, the name was changed to the Service Star Legion. The name War Mothers of America is nearly lost to history. We also wish to note the passing of two of the people who contributed to this project. After finishing production, we were saddened to learn of the death of retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Tom Orlowski, who contributed much to this project with his knowledge of the 1st Infantry Division and military operations. Then, in November, Gertrude Lant, granddaughter and namesake of Gertrude Schultz, died at the age of 96. With her passing, there is now no one left with personal knowledge of the woman who started a national movement to support the troops in World War I. I'm Steve Berger. Chester and Gertrude at War is a production of WNIN Tri-State Public Media. The president and CEO of WNIN is Brad Kimmel. Rick Briscoe created the sound design and edited the program. The voice of Gertrude Schultz is Marta Briscoe. The voice of Chester Schultz is A.J. Casey. The voice of Lieutenant Maury Maverick is Zach Evans. The voice of Luther Riley is Matt Sullivan. And the voice of General John J. Pershing is Jay Yazer. The local newspaper accounts are voiced by David James. We hope you enjoyed the program. This kind of high-quality journalism is only possible with your support. Please consider making a contribution today to your local public media organization.